At around the same time, Gao went back to the nursery to check on Charlie. She didn't want to disturb his sleeping, so she only turned on the light in the bathroom. It was now cold enough outside that she closed the half-open window and plugged in an electric heater. But as she approached the crib, she was alarmed that she couldn't hear the baby breathing. In the dim light, he didn't look to be in the crib, but she felt all over with her hands to make sure. She went through the connecting door to the Lindbergh's bedroom and found Anne as she was coming out of the bathroom. "Do you have the baby, Mrs. Lindbergh?" Gao asked anxiously.
"No,"
Anne replied, confused. "Perhaps Colonel Lindbergh had him," she suggested, then went to the nursery while Gao ran downstairs to the library. "Colonel Lindbergh, have you got the baby?" Gao asked. Then, since Lindbergh was known as a notorious practical jokester, she added, "Please don't fool me." Lindbergh expressed surprise that Charlie wouldn't be in his crib, getting up quickly to examine the nursery for himself. He strode into his and Anne's bedroom, went to the closet, grabbed his rifle, and loaded it. Then with Anne, he went back to the nursery. The crib was empty, and the room was surprisingly cold. Lindbergh glanced over and realized the corner window, the one with the warped shutter, was unlatched and slightly open. On top of a radiator enclosure just under the window, Lindbergh noticed a small white envelope. He had the restraint and presence of mind not to touch it before authorities arrived. "Anne," he said, "they have stolen our baby. My son has just been kidnapped." At about 10:25 p.m., Ollie Whateley called the Hopewell Sheriff's Office to report the crime. Lindbergh himself called his attorney and close friend Henry Breckenridge in New York City. Then he called the New Jersey State Police in Trenton, where he spoke to Lieutenant Daniel J. Dunn.
"This is Charles Lindbergh," he said. "My son has just been kidnapped."
Dunn asked him when it had happened, and for a description of the baby and what he was wearing. After hanging up, Dunn described the call to Detective Louis J. Bornman. They discussed the matter briefly, and to make sure it wasn't a prank, decided Dunn should call the Lindbergh house to confirm that the voice he had spoken to was, in fact, the Colonel's. When Lindbergh answered the phone, Dunn reported that the police were on their way. Meanwhile, Lindbergh went outside hunting for signs of the intruder, but found nothing. The first officers on scene, local sheriff's deputies, arrived at 10:40. They looked inside the nursery and outside the corner window, where they noticed impressions in the ground. From there, they followed a set of footprints 75 feet away from the house toward the southwest, where they found a wooden ladder, obviously homemade, lying on the ground. Light in weight, it was rather crudely constructed in two sections that folded together with the rungs seemingly inconveniently far apart, and the side rail of the upper section had split. About 10 feet beyond, they discovered a third section of ladder, designed to fit on top of the other two. When fully unfolded and assembled, the ladder measured about 20 feet, but could be collapsed down to 6.5 feet. At 10:46, a teletype alarm was sent across the state instructing police to stop any car that might be carrying a child dressed in a sleeping suit. By 11 o'clock, the statewide roadblock was in place, and the state police of Delaware, New Jersey, and Connecticut had also been notified. The first state trooper to arrive at the house was Corporal Joseph A. Wolfe from Lambertville, who reached the house at 10:55. A number of other officers and officials followed, including Colonel H. Norman Schwarzkopf, the 37-year-old chief of the New Jersey State Police, West Point graduate, and World War I Army veteran, and father of the commanding general of the Desert Storm campaign against Iraq. He was accompanied by his second-in-command, Major Charles Schoeffel. Betty Gao searched the house from cellar to attic on her own, opening every closet. Anne went back to her bedroom, opened a window, and leaned out. She heard what sounded like a cry, but Elsie Whateley assured her it was just a cat. Corporal Wolfe noted yellow clumps of mud or clay on a suitcase beneath the corner window of the nursery. He then went outside to investigate and saw footprints in the wet ground below the window. He didn't have a ruler or tape measure, so he compared the impressions to his own size 9 shoe and found the prints larger. No plaster casts were ever made. By 11:15, other troopers had arrived. They reported seeing two sets of footprints made by two different people, but later changed their story to say they had only seen one. This is somewhat ambiguous, only one of many ambiguous aspects of this highly troubling case. One explanation is that they concluded the smaller set of prints were actually Anne's. She said she had been outside the nursery earlier in the day and had thrown pebbles up to the window to try to attract the baby's attention. But as reported by Berg and others, beneath the window, near where the ladder had evidently stood, was a clear shoe print with a textile design, suggesting that socks or a bag of some sort had been worn over the shoe. Near the ladder impressions, officers found another potential piece of evidence, a 9.5-inch long, wood-handled, 3/4-inch carpenter's chisel, manufactured by Buck Brothers Company. The investigators wondered why the dog had not alerted the household to a potential intruder, but Lindbergh explained that Wagush had been on the far side of the house, where he slept, and would not have heard anything that far away, above the wind noise. By this time, Lindbergh's lawyer, Henry Breckenridge, had arrived. He accompanied his friend and client, and Schwarzkopf and other officers, into the nursery. Corporal Frank A. Kelly from the Morristown Barracks, the crime scene technician, dusted for fingerprints. With the exception of one inconclusive smudge, no prints were discovered. Not even those of Anne Lindbergh or Betty Gow, a fact that continues to confound and attract controversy to this day. Kelly took photographs and collected samples of the mud on the leather suitcase and the hardwood floor around the window. Breckenridge called FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. They had met and become friends while Breckenridge served as Assistant Secretary of War during the Harding administration. Ironically, Hoover had been among the Lindberghs' distinguished house guests at Hopewell, along with the likes of Amelia Earhart, Will Rogers, Wiley Post, and Albert Einstein. Hoover assured Breckenridge of full cooperation. The ladder was brought inside before Kelly had a chance to photograph it in a preserved crime scene. He dusted for prints, but found none of any use. Soil on the rungs appeared to be of the same consistency as that found in the nursery. He also dusted the chisel, but found no prints there, either. Kelly turned his attention to the white envelope in the nursery, carefully slitting it open with his penknife. He removed a single folded sheet of white paper. The note was written in blue ink, in a shaky hand. He handed it over to Lindbergh. "Dear Sir!" exclamation point. "Have $50,000 ready," misspelled R-E-D-Y, $25,000 in $20 bills, $1,500 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2-4 days, we will inform you where, misspelled W-E-R-E, to deliver the money, misspelled capital M-O-N-Y. We warn you for making any ding public or for notify the police. The child is in gut care. Indication for all letters are signature and 3 holes. This last statement referred to the bottom right-hand corner of the sheet. There were 2 interlocking blue circle outlines, each a little more than 1 inch in diameter. The area where the 2 overlapped had been colored red, and 3 small holes had been punched into the design about 1 inch apart at the left, center, and right. No prints were on the letter. By the time it was light, scores of reporters had found their way to the estate, tramping over the property. Schwarzkopf had established a police command post in the 3-car garage on the side of the house opposite the nursery, but he found it impossible to protect the area from contamination. Stories began surfacing of strange people in the area. Ollie Waitley said he had seen a man and a woman in a green automobile drive up to the estate to take photographs. He had sent them away, but later saw the woman behind a bush taking photos and focusing on the nursery window. 2 men in a blue-black sedan were reportedly asking around on Tuesday how to find the Lindbergh estate. The car was traced to a resident of Brooklyn, who said it had been stolen that day. In Trenton, police were told that at midnight, railroad brakemen had seen 2 men and a woman with a child on the platform, waiting for the New York-bound train and appearing nervous and agitated. These people were never identified. Schwarzkopf requested a list of everyone who had worked on the house, all to be checked out. He also asked for the names of all servants both in Hopewell and at Next Day Hill to follow up the possibility of an inside job. No one could understand why the kidnapper or kidnappers had taken such risks, rather than wait until everyone in the house would likely be asleep, and the child's disappearance would go unnoticed longer. That, and the fact that the dog had not barked, helped focus the chief's attention on the domestic staff. Yet at the same time, he had to acknowledge that the Lindbergh home was far from unknown outside the family. Its construction had been featured in magazines all over the country, with elaborate photos and floor plans. The house sat on one of the highest points in the state, and would have been fairly visible, especially at night, to anyone secluded in the woods. And with only one road leading in and out, the family's movements were easily monitored. That the offender had brought a chisel with him suggested he didn't know the shutter could not be completely closed. Since the baby's blanket was still essentially in place in the crib, it appeared that he had been pulled out by the head and therefore possibly handled roughly. There were no odors of chloroform, but that did not rule out the use of some chemical or drug to quiet or neutralize the child. Taking charge. Lindbergh had built his career and reputation on controlling himself and whatever situation in which he found himself. With the life of his son at stake, he was not about to give up control here, and with his fame and influence, he had the clout to exert control and take charge, even in the face of a police investigation. Schwarzkopf, who deeply admired the aviation hero, essentially had to work around him. In consultation with Breckenridge, Lindbergh decided that the best chance of securing the return of the baby was to do what the kidnappers asked. But this was not an easy task. In the first few days after the abduction, thousands of pieces of mail were received at Hopewell. Three state police officers worked full-time sorting through it all, looking for clues. It's important to remember that during those Depression years, kidnapping had become a common criminal enterprise. There were even kidnapping syndicates in some of the major cities. Going back only 2 years, to 1930, 400 abductions had been reported in Chicago alone. The day after Charlie Lindbergh disappeared, a boy in Niles, Ohio was taken. That March, 16 kidnappers were convicted and sent to prison. In fact, Anne's younger sister had come close to being abducted in 1929. During the wait for further word from the kidnappers, several working theories were evolving. Lindbergh believed the offenders were professionals because of the absence of prints and the apparent knowledge of the house and the baby's room. He suspected a gang was involved and wanted to get in touch with the underworld to see if a deal could be worked out. Because of the kidnappers' apparent familiarity with the house and the location of the nursery, the construction of the ladder, and the relatively modest ransom request, Norman Schwarzkopf believed the offenders were local and non-professional. Lieutenant Arthur T. Keaton, Schwarzkopf's principal detective, wanted to pursue the possibility that the kidnapping had been an inside job, the work of domestic employees, since somehow the offenders knew that the family was not returning to the Morrow estate right after the weekend, as was their established custom since the baby was ill. They had never before spent a Tuesday night in Hopewell. Charles and Anne expressed total faith in the family servants from the very beginning and never wavered in that faith. As with Lizzie Borden 40 years earlier, Lindbergh raised some eyebrows by his seemingly overly stoic reaction to Charlie's abduction. He was so unemotional, it was said, that either A, he did not really love his son in the normal human way, or B, he had to have had something to do with the crime. The rumors began to resurface about the little boy being somehow defective, either mentally or physically, and that the perfectionist colonel couldn't deal with this. I bring this up here primarily to shoot it down. First of all, there was absolutely no remotely creditable evidence to suggest anything was abnormal about the child. But more to the point, I have seen enough parents in times of terrible grief to know that emotional reaction to such horror is very individual. Some people let the floodgates open up. Others maintain a quiet and icy control. Most are somewhere in the middle. But no reaction is right or wrong. Everyone who faces what must be the worst thing that can happen to a person copes as he or she must. One time when I was on the television program America's Most Wanted, I was talking to host John Walsh about this subject as it related to a case they were currently featuring. Walsh, whose career as a pursuer of predators had its origins with the horrible murder of his young son Adam, put it succinctly. Who are any of us to say how a person is supposed to react to something like this? In the case of Lizzie Borden, the detachment reflected the mindset of a calculating murderess. In the case of Charles Lindbergh, it reflected the personality of a man who had regularly faced death and gotten through the experience by not going to pieces. So each reaction means something different. If surface behavior were that easy to interpret, it would take little or no training, and anyone could be a profiler. Anne did whatever she could to cope, relying heavily on the emotional support of her mother and confessing her fears to her own diary. Her father, Dwight, always a source of strength, had died in his sleep of a cerebral hemorrhage the previous October 31st. Those around Anne worried that the stress and sleeplessness might threaten her pregnancy. In an attempt to do something constructive, on the morning after the abduction, she wrote out the baby's diet and offered it to the press. The diet appeared the following day on the front page of virtually every newspaper in America. Anne and Charles also published a statement in those same newspapers expressing their desire to make personal contact with the kidnappers or to communicate with them through any intermediaries they might designate. They said they would keep all pledges of secrecy and were only interested in getting their child back, that they would not try to injure in any way those connected with the return of the child. New Jersey Attorney General William A. Stevens issued his own statement, empathizing with the Lindberghs' anguish and desire to get their child back, but making it clear that the kidnappers were in no way being offered immunity. On March 2nd, a postcard arrived that said, "Baby safe. Instructions later. Act accordingly." No red and blue circles were present, and the handwriting was different from that of the note found in the nursery, but police certainly took it seriously. However, they were able to trace it to a mentally disturbed 17-year-old boy who wanted to see if it would get into the newspapers. The demands. On March 4th, a second ransom communication arrived, scolding Lindbergh for involving the police and upping the monetary demand to $70,000 because of the additional security and administrative concerns this imposed on the offenders. The same signature of interlocking circles appeared at the bottom of the note. It was handwritten in ink on both sides of the paper and had been mailed from Brooklyn, New York. "Dear Sir, we have warned you note to make any ding public. Also notify the police. Now you have to take consequences. Means we will halt the baby until everything is quite," spelled Q-U-I-T-E. "We can note make any appointments just now. We know very well what it means to us. It is really," spelled R-E-L-Y, "necessary to make a world affair out of this, or to get your baby back as soon as possible, to settle those affair in a quick way, will be better for both sites. Don't buy afraid about the baby. Two ladies," spelled L-A-D-Y-S, "keeping care of its day and night. She will also fed him according to the diet. Sintuary," spelled S-I-N-T-U-E-R-E, "on all letters. We are interested to send him back in gut health, and ransom was made aus, A-U-S, for $50,000, but now we have to take another person to it and probably have to keep the $25,000 in $20 bill, $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. Don't mark any bills or take them from one serial normer. We will form you ladder, were, to deliver the money, M-O-N-Y, but we will not do so until the police is out of the case," spelled C-A-C-E, "and the papers," spelled P-A-P-P-E-R-S, "are quiet," spelled Q-U-T-E. "The kidnapping we prepared for years, so we are prepared for everything." Thinking that this note might have been intercepted by the police, the offender sent another letter to Breckinridge's office to be delivered to Lindbergh. "Dear Sir, did you receive our," spelled O-U-E-R, "letter from March 4? We sent the mail on one off the letter, near Borough Hall, Brooklyn. We know police interfer with your privat mail. How can we come to any arrangements this way? In the future, we will send our, spelled O-U-E-R, letters to Mr. Breckenridge at 25 Broadway. We believe police, spelled P-O-L-I-S-E, captured our letter and let note forwarded to you. We will not accept any go-between from your side, spelled S-E-I-D. We will arrange, spelled A-R-R-A-N-G-H, these, spelled T-H-E-A-S, later. There is no worry about the boy. He is very well and will be feed according to the diet. Best dank, spelled D-A-N-K, for information about it. We are interested to send your boy back in gut health. It is necessary to make a world affair out of it, or to get your boy back as soon as possible. Why did you ignore our, spelled O-U-E-R, letter, which we left in the room? The baby would be back long ago. You would not get any result from police, spelled P-O-L-I-S-E, because our kidnapping was planned for a year already, spelled A-L-L-R-E-D-Y. But we were afraid the boy would not be strong enough. Our, spelled O-U-E-R, ransom was made out for $50,000, but now we have to put another to it as properly, spelled P-R-O-P-P-E-R-L-Y, have to hold the baby longer as we expected, so it will be $70,000, $20,000 in $50 bills, $25,000 in $25 bills, $12,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. We warn you again not to mark any bills or take them from one, sir, no. We will inform you later how to deliver the money, spelled M-O-N-Y, but not before the police, spelled P-O-L-I-S-E, is out of this case, spelled C-A-C-E, and the papers, spelled P-A-P-P-E-R-S, are quite. Now, despite what I just said about not everyone being able to be a profiler, I think you'll agree that a couple of things come across loud and clear in these notes. The letter writer's first language is not English. He is not American-born, even American-born illiterate. Though many of the basic words are badly misspelled, he got a lot of the hard ones right, which suggests he was using a dictionary. Rather than an illiterate American, the communications suggest a Germanic language speaker, as evidenced by such spellings as gut for good, and phonetic spelling such as ding instead of thing. So Lindbergh had to be wrong from the get-go. This was not the work of any organized crime organization in the United States. They wouldn't be so sloppy on communicating something so directly related to their business. It's just too unprofessional. Also, they would have asked for far more money and would have made a direct threat if their demand was not met. Could it be that more than one person was involved? Maybe, maybe not. We wouldn't know that from the letters. The notes certainly appeared to have been written by one person, and none of the myriad of handwriting experts eventually brought into the case disagreed with that presumption. However, kidnappers often communicate as we, even if there is only one, to project more strength and organization than they actually have. And this one was clearly doing that in claiming that the crime had been planned for a year already. Despite what appears obvious from this perspective, Lindbergh decided to deal with the criminal underworld. Al Capone, who had been the king of organized crime in Chicago until brought down on tax evasion charges, was at the moment residing in Cook County Jail in preparation for transfer to the federal penitentiary in Atlanta. Capone, who had ruthlessly stamped out his competition such as Jaime Weiss, and then had seven men in a Northside garage massacred on St. Valentine's Day 1929, while searching unsuccessfully for Weiss's successor, George Bugs Moran, expressed himself outraged and morally offended that such a crime had taken place and personally offered a $10,000 reward for information leading to the safe recovery of the child. He also told Hearst newspaper columnist Arthur Brisbane that he was pretty sure the mob had done it and he thought he could get the baby back, if he could be let out of jail long enough to accomplish the mission. Not surprisingly, the feds would have none of it. But Lindbergh believed in the mob connection and announced that a pair of bootleggers, Salvatore Spitali and Irving Bitts, would be authorized by him to deal with the kidnappers. Their associate, Morris Rosner, took over as Lindbergh's secretary, and on March 12th claimed that the baby was alive and negotiations were progressing well. He asked for $2,500 in personal expenses, which Lindbergh gave him. A little later, Spitali and Bitts unintentionally proved their underworld bona fides by getting arrested and charged with criminal conspiracy by federal prohibition agents for a shipload of bootlegged booze that had come into a dock in Brooklyn. Their connection with Lindbergh, however, was enough to have the charges summarily dropped. Meanwhile, perhaps the strangest and most enigmatic figure of all entered the case. Enter Jaffe. John F. Condon, 72 years of age with a distinguished white mustache and always neatly turned out in a dark suit and vest, was a retired physical education teacher and principal in the Bronx, a place he considered the most beautiful in the world. Though he was almost universally referred to as Doctor, we have found no specific reference to a Ph.D., and he was certainly not a medical doctor. Jim Fisher, an FBI special agent during my early years with the Bureau and now a professor and writer, describes Condon in his important book, The Lindbergh Case, as perceiving himself as a scholar-athlete. I would surmise from Condon's subsequent behavior with both the media and law enforcement authorities that he must have been the kind of teacher who liked to stand up in front of the class and hear himself talk. He would pontificate at the drop of a hat. He was also deeply patriotic in an ingenuous, almost mawkish way. He was appalled by this crime against America's greatest hero, thought it was a national disgrace, and wanted to do something to help. Just as likely, I think, he wanted to have some personal connection and self-importance in what was shaping up as the biggest story of the age. After reading about the role these cheap thugs Spitali and Bitts were playing, Condon wrote a letter to the Bronx Home News, which appeared in the March 8th edition, offering his own services as intermediary with the kidnappers and pledging $1,000 of his own hard-earned savings to add to the ransom. I think this one fact says a lot about that sense of self-importance. Since the paper was hardly known outside the Bronx, no one in the investigation gave Condon's offer much attention, if they knew of it at all. Certainly Lindbergh did not. The day after his letter appeared in print, Condon was out of his house until around 10 in the evening. When he returned home, the first thing he did, as was his habit, was to sort through the day's mail. One envelope was in a primitive handwriting. Inside was the following handwritten letter. "Dear Sir, if you are willing to act as go-between in the Lindbergh case, please follow strictly instruction. Handle enclosed, spelled I-N-C-L-O-C-E-D, letter, personally, spelled P-E-R-S-O-N-A-L-Y, to Mr. Lindbergh. It will explain everything. Don't tell anyone about it. As soon as we find out, the press or police is notified," spelled N-O-T-I-F-Y-D. "Everything are cancel," spelled C-A-N-C-E-L-L, "and it will be a further delay. After," spelled A-F-F-T-E-R, "you get," spelled G-E-T-T, "the money," spelled M-O-N-Y, "from Mr. Lindbergh, put these three words in the New York American. Money," spelled M-O-N-Y, "is ready," spelled R-E-D-Y, all caps. "After," spelled A-F-F-T-E-R, "notice," spelled N-O-T-I-S-E, "we will give you further instruction. Don't be afraid," spelled A-F-F-R-A-I-T, "we are not out for," spelled F-O-R-E, "your $1,000. Keep it. Only act strictly," spelled S-T-R-I-C-L-Y. "Be at home every night between 6-12. By this time, you will hear from us." Inside the envelope was a smaller one, bearing two lines in the same handwriting. "Dear Sir, please handle," spelled H-A-N-D-E-L, "enclosed," spelled I-N-C-L-O-C-E-D, "letter to Colonel Lindbergh. It is in Mr. Lindbergh's interest not to notify the police." Despite the warning not to tell anyone, Condon didn't feel he could exactly keep quiet about so momentous a development. For one thing, he concluded, He would have to get this communication to his hero, Colonel Lindbergh, and he didn't have a car. He decided to confide in his friend Al Reich, who did. Reich was a former prizefighter who now worked in real estate and was known to hang out at Max Rosenhein's restaurant at 188th Street and the Grand Concourse. Condon took a trolley, but when he got to the restaurant, Reich wasn't there. Not able to contain himself, Condon showed the letter to Rosenhein, who suggested he show it also to another friend of both men, Milton Gallio, a clothing salesman who happened to be there at the time. Gallio did have a car and agreed to drive Condon to Hopewell. The three discussed exactly how they should go about this, finally concluding that it would be best for Condon to call first and establish his credibility. Condon got through, but was handed off from voice to voice until he got to someone who said he took all of Colonel Lindbergh's calls. This was his personal secretary, Robert Thayer. Condon explained who he was, spewing out a long list of his academic credentials and teaching positions. At this point, accounts diverge. Thayer stated that he alone spoke with Condon. Condon, who was much given to pomposity and self-aggrandizement, claimed that he then spoke directly to Lindbergh. I tend to doubt this version, but in any event, Condon did read the letter, then was asked to open the accompanying envelope and read its contents aloud. Dear Sir, Mr. Condon may act as go-between. You may give him the $70,000. Make one packet the size will be, spelled B-E-E, about. Condon explained that a drawing of a box indicated the size should be 7 inches by 6 inches by 14 inches, then continued reading. We have notify you're already in what kind of bills. We warn you not to set any trap, spelled T-R-A-P-P, in any way. If you or someone else, spelled E-L-S, will notify the police, there, spelled T-H-E-R, will be a further delay. After, spelled A-F-F-T-E-R, we have the money, spelled M-O-N-Y, in hand, we will tell you where to find your boy. You may have a airplane ready, spelled R-E-D-Y. It is about 150 mil, M-I-L, away, A-W-Y. But before, spelled B-E-F-O-R, telling you the address, a delay of 8 hours, spelled H-O-U-E-R-S, will be between. Is that all? The listener, whether Lindbergh or Thayer, asked. Condon said it was, but then added the two interlocking circles at the bottom of the note. That got the listener's attention. It was agreed that Lindbergh should have the letter right away, so Condon, Rosenhein, and Gallio set out for Hopewell shortly after midnight in Gallio's car. They arrived around 2 a.m. and were met by Henry Breckinridge in the kitchen. Condon was taken to an upstairs bedroom to meet with Lindbergh. As soon as he saw the handwriting, the misspellings, and the signature circles, Lindbergh knew the note was authentic. None of that had been made public. The sketch of the box was rendered in perspective and looked like something a carpenter might draw, which might also then tie in with the obviously homemade ladder. Condon's account of that night is so flatulent it's almost stomach-turning. When he was introduced to Anne, he writes, "She stretched out her arms towards me instinctively in the age-old appeal of motherhood. Will you help me get my baby back? I shall do everything in my power to bring him back to you." As I came closer to her, I saw the gleam of tears in her soft, dark eyes. I smiled at her, shook a thick, reproving forefinger at her. With mock brusqueness, I threatened Anne Lindbergh, "If one of those tears drops, I shall go off the case immediately." She brushed away the tears. When her hands left her face, she was smiling sweetly, bravely. "You see, doctor, I am not crying." "That is better," I said. "That is much, much better." Not only is this reminiscence just plain icky, it also goes against the far deeper and genuinely sensitive portrait of Anne that comes across in her own writings. But it does give us an important insight into John Condon's personality and perspective. Rosenhein and Gallio drove back to the Bronx, but Lindbergh invited Condon to spend the night, an invitation Condon readily accepted. He went even further than that. Early in the morning, he strolled into the baby's nursery, looked around, then went into, as he called it, the lone eaglet's crib, and removed the two safety pins that still fastened the baby's blanket to the mattress. At the toy chest, he took out some carved wooden animals. He then asked Lindbergh if he could take the toys and safety pins with him so that if and when he did meet up with the kidnapper, he could identify the baby by his reaction to his animals and qualify the kidnapper by asking where he had seen them before. Lindbergh agreed, and after breakfast, he, Breckinridge, and Condon went upstairs and drafted a short note. "We hereby authorize Dr. John F. Condon to act as go-between for us." The note was dated March 10, 1932, and signed by both Charles and Anne. The problem of the press came up again. Breckinridge was prepared to place the "Money is Ready" notice in the New York American according to the instructions in the note, but if Condon signed it, reporters would immediately know he was the intermediary and besiege him. That would be the end of the negotiations. So Condon suggested using his initials, JFC, to come up with the name Jaffsy. The kidnappers would recognize it, but no one else would. Before being driven home to the Bronx by Breckinridge, Condon spent more than an hour studying family photographs of Charlie so he'd recognize the child on sight. Breckinridge would spend evenings at Condon's home at 2974 Decatur Avenue until they heard from the kidnappers. Violet. That same day, detectives from the Newark Police Department set about the routine interviewing of all 29 domestic servants in Mrs. Morrow's employ at Next Day Hill. Betty Gow was an obvious potential suspect in Schwarzkopf's mind. She had both knowledge of the baby's whereabouts and direct access to him. She had also worked in Detroit, where a mobster called Scotty Gow operated, sometimes dabbling in kidnapping for profit. But no connection could be established between him and Betty, and all of her responses to investigators seemed genuine and appropriate. The New Jersey State Police also had the Hartford, Connecticut department pick up Gow's boyfriend, Red Johnson, for questioning. In addition to having knowledge of the child's whereabouts on March 1st, he also drove a green Chrysler coupe, and one local resident had reported a green automobile in the vicinity of the Lindbergh house. Close to 400 green cars had already been checked out, but when detectives examined Johnson's Chrysler, they found an empty milk bottle in the rumble seat. Johnson explained forthrightly that he drank a lot of milk and tossed the containers in the back seat while he was driving. Police held him for more than a week, but could never shake his story, and nothing in his background suggested he could be involved with the crime. Ultimately, the investigation of Johnson led nowhere, and 2 weeks after the kidnapping, Schwarzkopf made a public statement exonerating Johnson. Unfortunately for him, however, he turned out to be an illegal alien, and Schwarzkopf was ultimately able to dispense with him completely by turning him over to the Immigration Service. As a group, the Morrow and Lindbergh servants were cooperative and matter-of-fact in their responses, with one surprise exception. Violet Sharp, 28 years of age, was a maid who had left her rural village in Bradfield, England in 1929 for Toronto, where she worked for 9 months, before moving to New York City to look for a better position. Shortly after registering with an employment agency, she was hired to work for the Morrows. Her sister Emily worked for Constance Chilton, who was the partner of Ann Lindbergh's sister Elizabeth in a private school. Photographs show Violet to be plain but pleasant-looking, slightly on the heavy side with short dark hair and large brown eyes. From all accounts, she was friendly, a good worker, and liked by everyone on the staff. She was thought to be romantically involved with Septimus Banks, the butler and head of the Next Day Hill household staff. Banks had previously served as butler to British aristocracy and to industrialist Andrew Carnegie. The other servants believed that someday Violet and Septimus would get married. The only thing that might stand in their way was the butler's alcoholism, a problem that had gotten him fired several times, but each time Mrs. Morrow had relented and welcomed him back. Violet got him to promise to stay off the bottle for a year. On the day of the kidnapping, Violet had been the one who had received Anne's telephone call to Next Day Hill, asking for Betty Gow. Before Betty left, she told Violet the baby was sick, so instead of the Lindberghs coming back here, she'd be going there. When they spoke to Violet, the detectives were expecting another routine interview, but it didn't go exactly that way. She seemed nervous and agitated, and in accounting for her whereabouts on March 1st, she told a convoluted story that didn't seem to go anywhere. At around 8 p.m., she had gotten a call from a man she'd met the previous Sunday while she was walking with her sister Emily in Englewood. A man drove by and waved. She assumed she knew him, so she waved back. He stopped and offered them a ride home. She didn't know him, as it turned out, but he seemed friendly and said he would call her to take her out. This, despite the fact that she had an understanding with Septimus Banks. Violet and this man went out together with another couple on the evening of March 1st. The four of them went to a movie. After the movie, he drove her back to Next Day Hill, walked her to the servants' entrance, and they said goodnight. She agreed to see him again on March 6th, but then broke the date. So who was this man? What was his name? Violet didn't remember. What about the other couple? She couldn't remember their names either. What movie did they see? She didn't remember. Well, then, what was it about? Nothing came to her. What was the name of the theater? It was in Englewood, but she didn't know the name. The detectives told her they knew this was trying and that she must be nervous. She snapped back that she wasn't nervous, but they had no business prying into her private life. They asked her to tell them anything else about her actions or whereabouts on the 1st of March, but she had nothing else to say. While she was being interviewed, other officers went through Violet's room. While no clues or direct evidence of anything was found, a deposit book from a New York City bank indicated a balance of around $1,600. Considering that this was in the midst of the Depression, that Violet's salary was $100 a month, that she had been working for the Morrows less than 2 years, and that she was regularly sending money home to her family in England, this sum called attention to itself. As she had no room or board expenses, it was technically possible for her to have saved so much if she was extremely frugal. But together with the hostility and evasiveness of the interview, it made police look at her far more closely than they would have if she'd reacted to their inquiries as the other servants had. Cemetery John. The ad signed Jaffsey appeared in the New York American on March 11th. That same afternoon, Mrs. Condon answered the telephone to a voice she later described as having a thick, deep, guttural accent. The caller asked for her husband. She said he was at Fordham University but would be back by 6 p.m. The caller said he would call again at 7 and suggested that Dr. Condon stay home and wait. By the time the mysterious man called again, Condon and Breckenridge had both returned home.
"Did you got it my letter with the signature?" he asked.
Condon immediately picked up on the Germanic verb form and the pronunciation of signature as it had been spelled in the letter.
"Where are you calling from?" Condon asked.
"Westchester,"
the man said, before asking Condon a few more qualifying questions. Condon distinctly heard him speaking to someone in the background. Then Condon heard a background voice saying,
"Stai zitto!"
Condon took that to be Italian, roughly for "shut up."
"You will hear from us,"
the caller promised, then hung up. Colonel Schwarzkopf had wanted to set up a trace on Condon's telephone, but Lindbergh had overruled him. The fact that Lindbergh could overrule the chief of the lead law enforcement agency on the case spoke directly to the aviator's enormous and unique power. Lindbergh had gotten where he was by exerting total control, both in his professional and personal lives. He believed that the best chance of getting his son back alive lay in playing straight with the kidnappers, and so the police had no way of using this call to Condon to help locate the offenders. Some of the people Lindbergh had chosen to work with, though, were difficult to control. On March 12th, Morris Rosner, Lindbergh's newly appointed personal secretary and liaison to organized crime, announced to the press that he knew that the baby was alive and well and would soon be returned to his parents. That same day, New York City Police Commissioner Edward Mulrooney announced that Rosner had just been indicted for land fraud. He was later acquitted. Some say it was because of the Lindbergh connection. On Saturday, March 12th, Condon went to a cabinet maker in the Bronx to have a wooden box constructed to the kidnapper's specifications. He had the design based on an old ballot box he had received years ago as a gift, so that it could easily be identified if it turned up in anyone's possession. He paid the cabinet maker $3. By 6 that evening, Condon was back at his house with his friend Al Reich and Henry Breckenridge when the doorbell rang. This had to be the communication they were waiting for, but it was just Milton Gaglio and Max Rosenhein. Breckenridge was worried that their visit might have scared off the kidnappers. Then around 8:30, the doorbell rang again. It was a taxi driver named Joseph Peroni, who explained that he had been given the envelope he was carrying by a man wearing a brown overcoat and brown felt hat who had hailed him on Gun Hill Road and Knox Place and asked him to deliver it to Dr. Condon. Upon further questioning from Breckenridge and Gaglio, Peroni said that the man spoke with a thick German accent and wrote down the license plate number of Peroni's cab before leaving. Condon opened the envelope, and they all read, "Mr. Condon, we trust you, but we will not come in your house," spelled H-A-U-S. "It is too," spelled T-O, "danger. Even you can note no if police or secret service," spelled S-E-R-V-I-S-E, "is watching you follow this instruction. Take a car and drive to the last subway station from Jerome Avenue here. 100 feet from this last station on the left side," spelled S-E-I-D-E, "is an empty Frankfurter stand with a big open porch around. You will find a notice," spelled N-O-T-I-S-E, "in center," spelled S-E-N-T-E-R, "of the porch underneath a stone. This notice," spelled N-O-T-I-S-E, "will tell you where to find us. Act accordingly." After 3/4 of an hour, spelled H-O-U-E-R, "be on the place. Bring the money," spelled M-O-N-Y, "with you." The now familiar signature circles were at the bottom of the note. The box wasn't ready, and neither was the cash, but Condon felt it was important to follow the instructions to the letter. When he arrived at his destination, he would explain to whoever met him. Al Reich would drive him to the location in his Ford coupe. At the closed hot dog stand, Condon got out of the car. On the porch, he found an envelope under a rock. He went back to the car and opened it. "Cross the street and follow the fence from the cemetery direction to 233rd Street. I will meet you." The cemetery in question was Woodlawn, a 400-acre burial ground separated from Van Cortlandt Park by a wrought iron fence. Condon waited at the front gate. Someone walked by and stared at Condon but kept on walking. Later, Reich stated he felt strongly that this individual was there as a lookout. Condon continued waiting about 15 or 20 more minutes until he saw someone inside the fence waving a white handkerchief at him. Condon looked closely. He was wearing a brown coat and fedora, just like the man Peroni had described. As he held the handkerchief in front of his face, he asked in a thick accent, "Did you got it, my note? Have you got it, the money with you?" It was the same voice Condon had heard on the telephone. "No," Condon responded. "I can't bring the money until I see the baby." They heard footsteps. The shadowy man accused Condon of bringing in the police. Condon insisted he wouldn't do that. The man hoisted himself up on the cemetery gate and jumped over, landing near Condon.
"It's too dangerous," he said,
then took off north on Jerome Avenue. Condon noted that the footsteps they had heard belonged to a cemetery guard. After assuring the guard that everything was all right, Condon took off after the man, not an easy task for a 72-year-old, even one who paid as much attention to his physical condition as Condon did. He finally caught up with the man about a half mile later at the southern tip of the lake in Van Cortlandt Park, when he stopped running. "You should be ashamed of yourself," Condon chided him in his pompous, professorial tone. "No one will hurt you."
"It was too much risk," the man countered, still doing his best to pull his hat down and his collar up to protect his identity. "It would mean 30 years.
The two men walked to a shack near the tennis courts. Condon pointed to the nearby bench. He estimated the man to be in his mid-30s, about 5'9", 160 pounds, with a small mouth, high cheekbones, and deep-set almond-shaped eyes. No longer assertive, the man now seemed preoccupied. He said again that he could get 30 years if he was caught.
"And I am only go-between. I might even burn."
"What was that you said about burning?" Condon asked.
"What if the baby is dead? Would I burn if the baby is dead?"
It was unclear whether he meant burning in hell or the New Jersey electric chair. Either way, Condon was distressed by the reference. No one had yet made any public reference to the possibility that the baby might already be dead, but though they hadn't addressed it with the Lindberghs, Schwarzkopf and his officers must have been considering it. Almost 2 weeks had gone by. Kidnapping is one of the riskiest major crimes, because it involves extended and ongoing dealing with the victims, who will almost always be in contact with the police. In the case of a well-publicized crime, everyone will be looking for the kidnapped child as well. It is therefore incumbent on the offender to get in and out of the crime as quickly as possible. The longer the ordeal drags on, the less chance he's kept the abductee alive. Condon confronted the stranger, asking what he meant. He said there was no point in this negotiation if the baby was dead.
"The baby is not dead," the man insisted. "The baby is better than it was. We give more to him to eat than we heard in the paper from Mrs. Lindberg. Tell her not to worry. Tell the colonel not to worry. The baby is all right."
Wanting to make certain the man with whom he was dealing was authentic, Condon asked several qualifying questions, then pulled out the safety pins he had taken from Charlie's crib. The man correctly identified them.
"What is your name?" Condon demanded.
"John."
Further questioning elicited that he was a Scandinavian sailor from Boston. The two men talked for more than an hour, during which time John said the baby was on a boat about 6 hours away by air, and that he was being well cared for by two women. He said further that the kidnapping gang consisted of four men, the leader of whom he said was a high-level government employee, that neither Betty Gow nor Red Johnson were involved, and that the crime had been planned for a year, waiting until the baby was old enough that they could keep him alive away from home. He said that on Monday he would send proof that his gang was actually holding the baby. "What would it be?" Condon wanted to know. The man replied he would send the baby's sleeping suit. When the cash was ready, Condon was to place an ad in the Bronx Home News. The man then rose, walked away, and disappeared into the darkness. It was about 10:45 p.m. Condon found Reich, and together they drove back to the house, where Breckenridge was waiting for a thorough debriefing. Condon said he was sure he could identify Cemetery John if he saw him again. Breckenridge called Lindberg. Condon had not seen the communication referring to the crime having been planned for a year, so when he reported this detail, taken with everything else, such as the accent and pronunciations, Breckenridge and Lindberg felt confident that Cemetery John was actually part of the kidnapping, rather than simply an opportunistic extortionist. Condon and Breckenridge composed an ad for the Bronx Home News. "Money is ready. No cops. No Secret Service. No press. I come alone, like last time. Jaffsy." On Sunday, March 13th, police brought Dr. Erastus Mead Hudson, physician and independent fingerprint expert, to see if he could do any better than the police had done. After meticulously working the crime scene, he was able to lift 13 prints from the baby's toys, which was important since Charlie, having been born at home rather than in a hospital, had never been fingerprinted. Hudson also found an astounding 500 or so partial prints on the ladder. Most of them were unusable, but this demonstrated how many individuals had been handling this crucial piece of evidence in this most publicized of all cases. The next day, Monday, Condon got a call from Cemetery John.
"There has been a delay sending the sleeping suit," he reported. "It will come. You will have it soon."
Then he hung up. On Tuesday morning, March 15th, a brown paper-wrapped package turned up in Condon's mail. Condon recognized the printing of the address and immediately called Breckenridge at his office. In less than an hour, Breckenridge was at Condon's house, where the two men opened the parcel. It was a carefully folded gray wool, one-piece, size 2, Dr. Denton sleeping suit with feet, and appeared to be authentic. A one-page note was enclosed with writing on both sides. On the front it said,
"Dear Sir, our," spelled O-U-E-R, "man failed to collect the money," spelled M-O-N-Y. "There are no more confidential conference after we meeting from March 12th. Those arrangements, too hazardous for us. We will note, allow our," spelled O-U-E-R, "man to confer in a way like before," spelled B-E-F-O-R. "Circumstances will note, allow us to make transfer,
spelled T-A-R-A-N-S-F-A-R-E, like you wish. It is impossibly for us. Why should, spelled W-Y-S-H-U-L-D, we move the baby and face danger? To take another person to the place is entirely out of question. It seems you are afraid if we are the right, spelled R-I-G-T-H, party, and if the boy is all right. Well, you have our signature. It is always the same as the first one, especially them three holes. This note did indeed bear the now familiar signature. On the back was written, Now we will send you the sleeping suit from the baby. Besides, it means $3 extra expenses because we have to pay another one. Please tell Mrs. Lindbergh, note to worry, the baby is well. We only have to give him more food, as the diet says. You are willing to pay the $70,000, note, $50,000, without seeing the baby first, or note. Let us know about that in the New York American. We can't do it other ways because we don't like to give up our safety, please, or to move the baby. If you are willing to accept this deal, put these in paper. I accept money is ready. Our program is, after 8 hours we have the money received, we will notify you where to find the baby. If there is any trap, you will be responsible what will follows. If there was any remaining doubt about the possibility of organized crime involvement, and there shouldn't have been, though several leads were still being followed up, this note should have squelched them. The idea of suddenly upping by $20,000 a ransom demand that had supposedly been planned for a year was ludicrous enough, but grousing that sending the sleeping suit as proof was costing them another $3 for a new one clearly demonstrated the level on which the offender or offenders were operating. By this time, Condon had met with Cemetery John and heard his accent, which tied right in with the spellings and syntax of the written communications. In certain respects, at least one of the offenders had profiled himself. At 1:30 the following morning, Lindbergh himself arrived at Condon's house. He had come in disguise to evade reporters. Lindbergh studied the suit for several minutes before proclaiming it authentic. Then he noted that it had been laundered since Charlie had worn it. He and Anne both felt the return of the suit was a good sign and didn't want the negotiations to drag on any longer than necessary. He also knew that Jaffsey's identity would not stay secret for long. He instructed Breckenridge and Condon to do exactly what the kidnappers demanded. They ran the money is ready notice, adding, John, your package is delivered and is okay. Direct me. Jaffsey. But nothing happened. Breckenridge placed another Jaffsey ad. Condon received a reply on Monday, March 21st. The letter was postmarked 2 days earlier from the Bronx. It again bore the interlocking circles. Dear Sir, you and Mrs. Lindbergh know our program. If you don't accept, then we will wait until you agree with our deal. We know you have to come to us anyway. But why should Mrs. and Mr. Lindbergh suffer longer as necessary? We will not communicate with you or Mr. Lindbergh until you write so in the paper. We will tell you again, this kidnapping case, spelled C-A-C-E, was, spelled W-H-A-S, prepared for a year already, so the police won't have any luck to find us or the child. You only pooch everything farther out. Did you send that little package to Mrs. Lindbergh? It contains the sleeping suit for the baby. The baby is well. The reverse side of the page bore a single line. Mr. Lindbergh, only wasting time with his search. Breckenridge was troubled by the note. It suggested that John had not seen the previous ads they had run. Things could be falling apart. They ran another ad in the Bronx Home News on Tuesday, March 22nd. It acknowledged again receipt of the sleeping suit evidence, but asserted the need to see the baby before the cash was handed over. There were obvious reasons for this, and not so obvious ones. In addition to the Jaffsey angle, Lindbergh was pursuing several other avenues, hoping that one would lead to Charlie's return. There was the Rosner-Spitali-Bitz connection, which, despite all of Rosner's blustering, had turned up nothing. There was also an industrialist in Norfolk, Virginia, named John Hughes Curtis, head of a boat-building company. He had gone to his Episcopal minister, Harold Dobson Peacock, with a story about repairing a boat for a rum runner who said he had been asked by the kidnappers to have Curtis act as go-between. Dobson Peacock had known the Morrows in Mexico City. Lindbergh didn't know what to make of Curtis's story, particularly after the Condon connection surfaced, but he was unwilling to completely dismiss it either. And then there was Gaston Bullock Means, a 32-year-old investigator who had been both a veteran of the Bureau of Investigation, the FBI's predecessor agency, and the defendant in a murder trial. He was acquitted, but his reputation continued to be somewhat shady, and when J. Edgar Hoover took over in 1924, he immediately got rid of Means. Means then got involved in a series of hustles that did get him thrown into the federal pen in Atlanta. When the Lindbergh kidnapping broke, Means got in touch with one of his former clients, Evelyn Walsh McLean, the wealthy Washington socialite, current owner of the Hope Diamond, and estranged wife of the publisher of the Washington Post. Means said that the kidnappers had asked him to take part in the crime, but upstanding soul that he was, he'd refused. However, this put him in a unique position to negotiate with them. He'd met the head of the gang while in the Atlanta penitentiary, and if Mrs. McLean would fork over $100,000, he was confident he could get the baby back safely. The heiress willingly put up the money, along with additional funds for Means's expenses. In the end, neither the Means nor the Curtis gambit proved to be real, and both men ended up being tried for fraud, convicted, and sentenced to jail time. Curtis's sentence was suspended. There was never any question in Charles Lindbergh's mind that he would pay the ransom. He sold much of his stock to raise the cash. The one agency he did call for help with the logistics was the Treasury Department, which put him in touch with the Internal Revenue Service's chief law enforcement officer, Elmer Irie. Irie had become something of a legend as the one who had developed the strategy to get Al Capone behind bars for income tax evasion. The Lone Eagle was still trying to play it completely straight with the kidnappers, but when Irie heard that Lindbergh intended to have the J.P. Morgan Company assemble 70 grand without even recording the serial numbers, he said he'd have nothing to do with the case unless it was handled in a more sensible way. Tracing ransom money can be one of the most effective ways of catching up with a kidnapper, and if Lindbergh was going to prevent this, Irie felt the investigation would be too hamstrung to be effective. Finally, Lindbergh agreed to do it Irie's way, after being convinced that this tactic could not endanger the baby. The kidnappers would have no way of knowing whether serial numbers had been recorded or not. Not only did Irie get the serial numbers of the ransom cash recorded, he came up with a highly creative nuance. The Treasury Department was already planning for the United States to go off the gold standard, which would take place in about a year. As part of the transition, remaining gold coins and gold certificate paper currency would be called. The bills would be replaced by silver certificates, which would not carry the characteristic round yellow seal of the gold notes. Irie's idea was to stack the ransom bills with gold certificates, which would be easy to spot once the nation was off the gold standard. He had his agents arrange the money into two packages that corresponded in denomination to what the ransom note had demanded. The first package was $50,000, all but $14,000 in gold notes. The second $20,000 package consisted of $450 gold notes, which would be easy to spot when passed. All serial numbers were non-sequential. What Lindbergh wouldn't go for, however, was to have the police anywhere near the money exchange, or to have Condon tailed until he met up with Cemetery John or an associate. Lindbergh and Breckinridge were concerned John was getting spooked, and then placed another Jaffe ad in the Home News edition of Sunday, March 27th. Money is ready. Furnish simple code for us to use in paper. Jaffe. On Tuesday, Condon found a response in his mailbox. Dear Sir, it is not necessary to furnish any code. You and Mr. Lindbergh know our program very well. We will keep that, spelled T-H, child, in our same place, spelled P-L-A-S-E, until we have the money in hand. But if the deal is not closed until the 8th of April, we will ask for 30,000 more. Also, note 70,000-100,000.
How can Mr. Lindbergh follow so many false clues? He knows we are the right party. Our signature is still the same as in the ransom note. But if Mr. Lindbergh likes to fool around for another month, we can help it. Once he has come to us anyway, but if he keeps on waiting, we will double our amount. There is absolutely no fear about, A-B-O-U-D, the child is well.
Lindbergh and Breckenridge took from this letter that they were running out of time. The kidnapper was annoyed by what he had heard about John Curtis claiming to be in touch with the gang, and fed up with what he perceived as the family's screwing around with him. I and my unit would have read it as increasing desperation on the offender's part that we could have exploited. Of course, the hands of everyone involved with the investigation were tied by Lindbergh's own management of the case, so it would have been difficult or impossible to get permission to set up a trap, something we'd done in other kidnapping cases, and could have done here had we been around yet. Since then, of course, the FBI has been involved in countless kidnapping investigations, and one of the things on which they pride themselves is virtually never losing the package, the ransom money. Breckenridge placed a Money is Ready ad in both the Home News and New York Journal editions of March 31st. On April 1st, Condon received the letter they'd been waiting for. Postmarked from Fordham Station, it instructed Lindbergh to have the money ready Saturday evening, to place an ad to that effect, and 8 hours after the money had been received, the location of the child would be revealed. Condon lobbied for a cash-and-carry arrangement, the money for the child, but Lindbergh was unwilling to take the chance of upsetting John. Lindbergh accompanied Breckenridge to Condon's house, where they turned over the ransom money to him to be placed in the specially constructed ballot box. They managed to get the first package in, but the additional $20,000 wouldn't fit, so Condon decided to carry it separately. On the afternoon of Saturday, April 2nd, the day the latest Jaffe ad had run, Lindbergh and Breckenridge waited with Condon and Al Reich in Condon's living room for word from John. Knowing the situation would be dangerous, Lindbergh told Condon he would be perfectly understanding if the old professor wanted to back out from the actual money exchange. Condon assured him he had no intention of backing out now. Colonel Schwarzkopf had reluctantly given his word that law enforcement would stay away. The money drop. At about 7:45 in the evening, a taxi driver rang the doorbell and left an envelope on the front steps. With Lindbergh and Breckenridge looking over his shoulder, Condon tore it open. Dear sir, take a care and follow East Tremont Avenue to the east until you reach the number 325 East Tremont Ave. It is a nursery. Bergen. Greenhouses, florist. There, spelled T-H-E-R, is a table standing outside right on the door. You find a letter underneath the table, covert with a stone. Read and follow instruction. On the reverse side, the offender warned, don't speak to anyone on the way. If there is a ratio alarm for police car, we warn you, we have the same equipment. Have the money in one bundle, spelled B-U-N-D-E-L. We give you 3/4 hour to reach the place. The plan was for Lindbergh to drive Condon to the meeting point and wait there for him. At the last minute, Reich suggested that Lindbergh take his Ford coupe. John had seen it, and so he wouldn't think a new or unexpected element had been added to the equation. The place they had been directed to was another cemetery, St. Raymond's. Tremont Avenue ran along its north side. The Bergen greenhouses referred to in the note were near the intersection of Tremont and Whittemore Avenues. Near the door to Bergen's flower shop, they saw the table. Lindbergh stopped the car in front. Condon got out and spotted the note held down by a rock. He brought it back to the car, and together the two men read it. Cross the street and walk to the next corner and follow Whittemore Avenue to the south. Take the money with you. Come alone and walk. I will meet you. Lindbergh said he was coming too, but Condon reminded him that the note said to come alone. Lindbergh reluctantly agreed, handing him the ballot box. Condon said he'd come back for it after he'd met with John. Instead of walking south on Whittemore, which was a dark, poorly lit dirt road, Condon headed east on Tremont where the light was better and he felt safer. But he couldn't see anyone, so he headed back to the car to report to Lindbergh. But before Lindbergh could answer, Condon heard a voice from the direction of the tombstones.
Hey, doctor!
It sounded like Cemetery John. There is a minor discrepancy in the stories at this point, one of many. According to some accounts, Condon answered,
All right.
Then the man called out,
Hey, doctor, over here, over here.
According to other accounts, Condon didn't respond until the man had called to him for the second time. This may be significant as to how much of the exchange Lindbergh himself heard, since he remained in the car and, years later, he was called upon to identify the voice. Had he allowed police surveillance of the scene, it would not have been so great an issue. Condon strode down Whittemore Avenue and into the cemetery, the direction from which the voice came. Inside, he saw a figure moving parallel to him through the gravestones. He began following the man down the hill into an access road bounded by a 5-foot-high cement wall. The man climbed over the wall, crossed the access road, scaled a low fence on the other side of the road, then crouched down below a hedge just to the left of where Condon was now standing. The man called out to him. Condon boldly told him to stand up. He recognized the man as Cemetery John. He was wearing a black suit and the same felt fedora.
Did you got it the money? He asked.
No, Condon replied. It's up in the car.
Who is up there?
Colonel Lindbergh.
Is he armed?
No, he is not.
This was a lie. Condon knew Lindbergh was carrying a revolver. He demanded the baby. John said he could not get the baby back for about 8 hours after the money was received. The two men went back and forth over this for several minutes.